Hello, welcome to Your Best School podcast. It is me, your host, Nicolette. I hope everyone's doing well out there and staying safe. You probably heard about the crazy weather, the power outage situation that we've been having here in Texas. So my closet studio is definitely colder than usual, that's for sure. We haven't lost any power. We're situated between like two hospitals and a psychiatric care center, so we think our grid is probably pretty secure. And we did only lose water for a little bit. So, you know, unfortunately, I can't say the same for, you know, a lot of other people, including my family in the Hill Country. They're like literally having to boil snow for water, and FEMA is there, and they're having to like set them up with water to even just, you know, flush their toilets. So, you know, it's a real mess. However, one of my aunts did post a picture on her outside deck, and the picture is a bottle of gin next to a martini glass with snow in it. So, you know, it appears that resourcefulness runs in our family. But, you know, speaking of that, I'd usually have, you know, a beer tonight. I like to have my beer while recording and share a little bit with y'all about, you know, the brewery and the beer and where you can get it. But, you know, seeing as how it's risky to ski to be driving, I opted for the wine that we already had at home, which is a like $17 Tempranillo from Kroger. And, you know, I'm not entirely mad at it. One of my favorite Tempranillos is usually like $35 a bottle. So to find one for, you know, half the price, you know, that's pretty exciting. I've had way too much coffee today. It's cold as shit. I'm exhausted. I've not been sleeping well. Joe got me some coffee accessories to make my own lattes, which was smart on his part because a few years ago I sat and did the math and I was spending easily like $7 a day buying coffee, which is like a $200 a month habit. So switched back to making it myself, thinking I'd save money, but now I've devolved into, you know, hoarding flavored creamers. So, you know, just traded one bad habit for another. Elephant in the room, you may have noticed there's been a bit of a lapse in episodes, and for that I apologize, but, situation is I've just been knee deep in working out some schooling stuff, and ongoing schooling stuff, which has been really, really, really time consuming. And, I feel like I spend, you know, half the fucking day either, you know, trying to study or on the phone with the school or registrar's office or, you know, emailing advisors, but you know, it's good. It's long overdue. I studied psychology in college and I'm expanding upon that education. So, you know, that's kind of what I've been up to. But also, I got a new job. So you are listening to a brand spanking new funeral services professional. I'll be working under this incredibly smart, female funeral director, and she's licensed embalmer. And she has 20 plus years in the industry. So she literally started working in the funeral home when she was like 16, 17 years old. I had actually just gone in to pick her brain, right? Like I just had some questions about the industry and, you know, she was willing to meet with me and, you know, we talked for about 2 hours and 2 hours later I had a second interview lined up. So, you know, that was kind of one of those, you know, happy accidents and is really exciting to say the least because it's not necessarily the easiest industry to get into. So I'm really, really pumped. The two homes that I'll be between are stunning. I mean, absolutely beautiful, whether you like that kind of thing or not. I mean, they're undeniably gorgeous. So you walk in and it's just so quiet and it's like lovingly decorated and ornate. And there's a reception room in each of them, as well as, you know, for the services. Yeah, you think it'd be customized, you know, kind of fit the family's preferences, but there's like a reception area and a service area. There's also an embalming or a prep room, one in each location. And one of the locations has a crematory as well. So it's really fascinating stuff. I already announced the new role on social media and I've had a few people ask me like, are you scared to be around, you know, the deceased or the decedents? And, you know, short answer, no, honestly, I already have been. And, you know, my thought process is this: there is nothing that I or anyone else at that funeral home, you know, could have done to prevent that person from being there, right? Like we don't have the power to, you know, undo or prevent those kind of things. However, I feel like what I can do and I have the threshold to do is to be there for those kind of people, you know, in their time of need and treat their loved one with respect and dignity. And I know I'm going to learn a lot and I really, really look forward to being a part of the field. It's, you know, it's really a privilege. So, you know, that's kind of what I've been up to and where I've been. But, you know, I do assure you we're going to be back on the, you know, once a week, if not twice a week. I'm going to shoot for twice a week episodes, but let's just say once, because I would much rather, you know, under promise and over deliver. Some general housekeeping, just a reminder that the Your Best School podcast shop has been live. The link is in my bio on social media, on Instagram, or through the Ghoul's Best Friend site. We've got t-shirts, sweatshirts, home tchotchkes, and all the money from the sales is going to go to improving the quality of this podcast, because it's just really cold in this closet. And I'd like to get some equipment so I can, you know, sit in a warmer place to record. What have we been watching? So we recently watched a show on Netflix called Ghosts of War. It's not a show, it's a movie. That's what I called it, but it's a movie. And what it is it's this World War II meets paranormal type movie. And it was written and directed by Eric Bress. And you may already know his work from Final Destination and one of my favorite movies, The Butterfly Effect. Fun fact about The Butterfly Effect, I went to the same acting and modeling schools, and God, I use that term so loosely, as Ashton Kutcher. Clearly that worked out a lot better for him than me, because he was in The Butterfly Effect and I'm recording a podcast in my closet. Anyways, so Ghosts of War. The movie follows these five American soldiers, and they're in World War II, and they're assigned to guard this, like, French chateau, which seems like a pretty sweet gig. And a nice respite from, like, you know, the foxhole and the combat horrors they've seen, until the ghosts show up, which isn't it always. Sorry, I had to get a drink. You know, I can't really say a ton about Ghosts of War without giving anything too important away, but it is a gory one. There's some good jump scares. And if you like a period piece, you're going to really enjoy Ghosts of War. I've always liked the History Channel, and I really like World War II documentaries and, you know, Holocaust documentaries. So if you combine horror movie with History Channel, I'm there. And best part, Billy Zane is in it, who has been a crush of mine since Titanic. And all these years later, he's still got it going on. So you can check out Ghosts of War on Netflix. And if you've already seen it, I would love to hear your thoughts on the movie. Speaking of movies, I'm really looking forward to The Conjuring 3. I've rewatched the teaser trailer several times. I think it's going to be good. They're saying it's going to be a lot different vibe than the first two. The Conjuring 3, The Devil Made Me Do It, as DigitalSpy.com is reporting, refers to the trial of Arnie Cheyenne Johnson, who pled not guilty to the manslaughter of his landlord, Alan Bono, on the grounds that he was possessed by a demon when the crime happened. And that one is slated for release in June of this year. So you've got a murder, you've got some good old-fashioned demon possession. Sign me up for The Conjuring 3 in June. This week, and you've got to be shitting me news, a TikToker named Demi Skipper has reportedly bartered her way from a bobby pin to a mobile cabin. According to Fox, Skipper first traded her bobby pin for $10 earrings. Over time, she has upped her trades for higher value items, including a MacBook. I don't know how the hell she did that. That's just impressive. I wanted a MacBook, but I had to, you know, manage my expectations and got a much more reasonably priced Acer. So maybe Homeworld can help me figure out how to trade up to a MacBook. But anyways, limited edition pair of Nike sneakers, a 2008 Dodge minivan, and more. And in the process, she amassed this huge viewership of like 4.5 million people. And she says that she used Craigslist and Facebook to make all of her trades. You know, what a gal, because I'm out here hemorrhaging money, you know, buying haunted grandma chairs and, you know, old funeral tintypes on Facebook Marketplace. And, you know, she went and got herself a house. So I got to say, if someone messaged me and they were like, hey, this is going to sound weird, hear me out, meet me up to trade this bobby pin, I'm assuming it's a trap, but I probably watch too much true crime. So that's that. Speaking of true crime, I'm really excited because tonight that is exactly the topic that we're going with. And this is my first true crime episode. You know, some of y'all have requested that, you know, kind of from the get-go, and I did the paranormal thing. Really excited to, you know, to do a true crime episode. And, you know, before we start, I do want to go ahead and cite my sources for tonight's podcast. I want to say a special thank you to ABC News, Fox, Netflix, and NBC. So, you know, go ahead, get comfy, grab yourself a drink and a nice cozy blanket and a throw pillow, because we're going to be talking about the case of Matt and Carrie Baker. So April 7th, 2006, near Waco, Texas. A man named Matt Baker calls 911 to report that he's found his wife, Carrie, unconscious in their bed. Now, according to Matt, and he's a pastor in Waco, he and Carrie were having a romantic rendezvous at home. I'm being euphemistic from the article I read. It was a little more graphic, but they were getting it on, right, at home. And he left to go run an errand to go to Blockbuster to pick up a movie for them to watch. So, you know, this is obviously, I guess, pre-Netflix, or they weren't, you know, doing the Netflix home delivery. He was, you know, he was having to leave to go get their Blockbuster video. So Pastor Matt Baker leaves to go pick up this movie. When he arrives back home, their bedroom door is locked. So he like tries the door, knocks on the door, yells for Carrie, but, you know, Carrie's not responding. So, he doesn't know what the hell's going on. So he decides he's going to go ahead and pick the lock. Now, before we get going, I want to pause and give a little background about this family and this couple. Matt was a pastor of a congregation in Waco, Texas. Waco, you may recognize the name from the Branch Davidians and David Koresh. It's a really, you know, cool town, a little bit infamous at this point, but that's where, you know, Matt had a congregation, and he and Carrie had two children. And the pair met back in college, and according to Carrie's mother, Linda Doolin, it was like this whirlwind romance, right? Like, it happened really, really quickly, and they actually got married just 3 months after meeting. Her family had some reservations about how fast the relationship was moving, but, you know, in my experience, it's honestly not, like, super uncommon in some churches for young adults to get engaged at, like, warp speed and married super fast. Like, even at my Christian college that I went to, you know, back a million years ago, you would go to freshman orientation, and the person giving the orientation would literally say to a bunch of 17 and 18 year olds, look to your left, look to your right, your future mate may be in sight. So, you know, they're a little more old school, right? Like, you know, getting married is, you know, is like kind of a goal, for some folks within these kinds of churches. And that was definitely seemed to be the case with, you know, Matt and Carrie. They're both very devout Christians, and Matt had aspirations of becoming a pastor, and Carrie totally supported him in that. So, you know, Matt, you know, does this thing, and he soon finds work as a Christian youth leader and also at a local YMCA as well. Carrie. So Carrie's described as a really bubbly person, like a really nice girl, former cheerleader and an athlete, and she had the kind of personality that people were drawn to. I found some pictures that I'm looking at of her, and she's this really, really beautiful, you know, super cute blonde, big doe eyes, a little button nose, and, you know, she does look like the kind of girl that, like, you'd want to work with or, like, sit next to in class. Like, she's pretty, but she's, you know, super approachable. So there's also some photos from their wedding. And, you know, they got married, you know, young and quick. And so, you know, that's what it looks like, that they look like this little, like, Ken and Barbie, really, really cute couple. She's got, like, the big 80s, 90s veil with, like, the V headband going down her forehead and, like, the big veil that, like, pomps up behind her super short bleach blonde hair. You know, they look really happy. And, you know, according to Carrie's mom, they really did seem to be, like, the perfect couple. And, you know, in stories like this, that phrase is always like, whoop. Like, that's a red flag for me, because if you've been in the, you know, the crime community for any length of time, you know that appearances can and usually are, and they're definitely deceiving. And it's kind of like when someone says after a crime, oh, it was the perfect town and things like that don't happen here. Like, this, that gave me the same vibe when I read that, you know, from Carrie's mom. So anyways, so Matt and Carrie get married quickly, and they, you know, get right to starting a family, and they have these two beautiful daughters, and things seem great. Like, you know, the world is their oyster. He's got this dream job, and they're this young, beautiful couple with these two cute kids. And then the worst happens, and their daughter Cassidy is diagnosed with a brain tumor at age 1, and she passes away just 4 months later. And there's this really sweet picture I'm looking at of Cassidy in Carrie's lap, and, you know, Cassidy's got, you know, like a little aux tube, you know, in her nose, and, you know, Carrie's cuddling her and kissing her head. And I mean, not to do the, like, as a mom thing, but, like, I can't even imagine, you know, being in their shoes. Like, that's just a nightmare, like, you know, having, you know, a terminally ill kid. And it goes without saying, this was obviously an incredibly devastating event for Carrie specifically. And she was just completely, you know, devastated and heartbroken, you know, by the loss of Cassidy. So after her death, the Bakers did then end up having another daughter. Now, keep in mind, this is on top of, like, everything else going on, right? Like, Matt's a preacher at a church, and that comes with its own set of duties and responsibilities. And even, like, if you grew up in the church, you'll know, you know, kind of what I mean. But, like, pastors' wives and their families have to, like, always be on. Like, they're, you know, doing Bible studies or, like, youth group or, you know, church functions. Like, it's not, like, if you marry a pastor, it's not just, his job. Like, there's very much like it's the whole family. And so, you know, on top of all of that, Carrie's also working as an elementary school teacher. And I'm sure, like, it was just incredibly difficult going through all those emotions and still needing to, you know, keep a brave face and a stiff upper lip and, you know, keep it together at work and in front of your congregation. And so she must have just been like a really tough person, had the patience of a saint. Like, my heart really goes out to her. Now let's fast forward back to that fateful night in April 2006. So Matt has just picked the lock to their bedroom and found his wife Carrie on their bed, and she's not breathing, and she's perfectly fine, you know, when he left to go get the movie from the video store. She's not breathing, and there are empty pill bottles on the nightstand, as well as some wine coolers and a typed, unsigned suicide note. So Matt says he starts trying to resuscitate her, you know, as you would. He calls 911, and you can look up and actually hear the 911 call. Matt can be heard telling the dispatcher, "My wife is lying in the bed, her lips are blue, her hands are cold, and there's a note, and it basically says, 'I'm sorry.'" And that's a quote from Matt from a Netflix documentary on murderous affairs that I watched on the case. But you can also find these videos online, too. And while being interviewed, Matt tells the police that he and Carrie were having, like I said earlier, an adult evening, and that he'd handcuffed her to the bed before he went to rent the video. And that part kind of made me go, what? Like, I mean, I'm not like kink shaming, right? Like, whatever you're into, but like, you've handcuffed her before you left? Like, what if there had been like a you know, fucking fire or something? So I don't know. That seemed kind of sus to me, but you know, I digress. So Matt goes on to tell the investigators that Carrie was very depressed and had threatened to commit suicide many times since the death of, you know, Cassidy. And in the note, Carrie talks about how she loves her kids and her family, and she's so sorry, but she just needed to go be with Cassidy. And it's just heartbreaking. And between the note, the pills, the alcohol, the police go ahead and, you know, immediately rule Carrie Baker's death a tragic suicide. Well, here's the thing. Carrie's family, the Doolins, are completely shocked. And they never got the feeling that she would take her own life. She hadn't expressed that to them, and they just never felt that she would leave her family behind. And they also had their own feelings, remember, about how quickly that relationship with Matt had progressed. So another thing they found really odd was that the suicide note was typed, and that's undeniably suspicious, and there was no way of proving that Carrie had written it, right? Like, it's typed. Anyone could have typed it. So basically, they straight up did not believe any part of Matt Baker's story. So they go to the Hewitt police and they demand the case be reopened, but the police decline. They're like, no, it's a suicide. It's straightforward. We believe the guy. Now, not to be deterred, the Doolins go ahead and they form their own group, and they call this group the Charlie's Angels of Waco, and they vow to find out the truth about Carrie's death. So they hire former assistant U.S. attorney Bill Johnson. And he quickly uncovers some unsavory information about our friend Matt Baker. So while working as a youth leader and at that YMCA, several young women and staff members complained about Matt making sexual advances toward them. And he was fired from the job, also at the YMCA, after being accused by four individuals of improper sexual conduct. Yikes. And surprise, Matt denies every bit of it, says, you know, none of it happened. So already we're seeing that Pastor Matt was perhaps not quite the great guy that he looked like on the surface or at the beginning of this story. And investigators continue to comb through the Baker's life. You know, they dig through cell phones, and the records show, get this, Carrie's phone being used regularly after her death. Now, obviously, they've got a few questions for Matt about this cell phone usage, right? So he reassures them there's a perfectly logical explanation. He gave the phone to a friend in need. Well, turns out this friend is a woman named Vanessa Bowles, who is a member of the church, recently divorced single mom. And looking at pictures here, and this is just my take, make of this what you will, but Vanessa also happens to be, you might have guessed it, young, blonde, and she's pretty hot. Like, she's pretty good looking. So when confronted about this friendship with this parishioner, Matt insists they're just friends, you know, because of course he did. Carrie's family's not buying it. Once this revelation, you know, comes to light, they're not buying it at all. And investigators really aren't either. And they just want to talk to Vanessa. Well, Vanessa also denies that anything is going on between her and the married pastor. She just sought out his guidance during her divorce. And the only problem, though, is this. One day, super, super shortly after Carrie's death, a church member who worked at a local jewelry store spots Pastor Matt and Vanessa Bowles at their work with the Baker children. The employee says, get this, the employee says they were there looking at engagement rings. At this point, the Doolins are positive Matt was leading a double life with Carrie while she was alive and that it may have somehow contributed to her death. So with all this information, of course, they fucking petitioned the police to reopen the investigation, and Carrie's body is exhumed for autopsy. And thankfully, you know, the police were fully on board this time. So that happens. Well, they do the autopsy and the toxicology reports come back with some interesting findings. Carrie's body had traces of Ambien, which if you've probably heard of it, but in case you haven't, it's a prescription sleep aid. And it's a prescription sleep aid that Carrie was not prescribed or taking. So that's pretty strange. They also find bruising around her mouth that could have been consistent with suffocation. And also the lividity of her body. The lividity is like the purplish, bluish discoloration that happens after death. It looks kind of like bruising, but it's like where blood pools. It leads them to believe that Matt wasn't being entirely honest about the timeline of when Carrie died and that she had probably been dead a lot longer than he claimed when he called 911. So things aren't looking so good for Pastor Matt, right? His timeline's fucked. He's lost a ton of credibility in his church. And the Doolins decide to hit him with a wrongful death suit. Good for them. Meanwhile, the Hewitt police do a dump on his online activity and find that he had done many searches on, you guessed it, sleeping pills, particularly sleeping pill overdoses. So in a taped deposition, which again, you can look it up and see or watch on Netflix, you see Matt being asked if he had done any searches for Ambien, which is a medication, I remind you, Carrie was not taking or prescribed. And, you know, he tries to pivot and say, well, I was looking at what the side effects for Ambien can cause. Well, I mean, I don't know. You just can tell watching this guy that he's one of those guys that thinks he like always has an answer for everything. And it's just like fucking super smug. He just seems insufferable, even in the deposition video. Now, remember Vanessa, the woman that he was seen looking at engagement rings with, the parishioner that was just a friend? Well, Vanessa isn't off the hook either. In her taped interview with investigators, Vanessa is seen very wide-eyed and innocent, explaining to the Hewitt police how she and Matt were just friends, and she was just being helped in a pastorly way, nothing inappropriate at all. So she goes on to say they didn't become romantically involved until after Carrie's death. Well, more keeps coming out. In another shocking discovery, Carrie's grief counselor that she'd started seeing after Cassidy passed away from cancer, she comes forward and she tells investigators about a very, very concerning conversation she had with Carrie, get this, weeks before her death. So Carrie told her therapist that she was sure her husband was having an affair and would do, quote, anything to get her out of the way, and that she found crushed up pills in her husband's briefcase. Well, when asked about the crushed up pills, Matt insists they must have belonged to Carrie. They were never in his briefcase. So again, Matt denies the entire thing. And during all this, the police are still putting the heat to Vanessa Bowles, and she actually ends up ending things with Matt. So, you know, the police still feel like Vanessa knows more than she's saying, right? Like they just are getting the feeling that she's covering for Matt, and she keeps sticking to Matt's exact story. Well, the police decide to bring in the big guns, and that is an investigator named Abden Rodriguez. Well, Rodriguez is well known, and it's for being really, really adept at getting confessions out of suspects. But Vanessa sticks to it, though. I mean, she denies the affair or any knowledge of Carrie's death or the circumstances surrounding it. And, you know, Rodriguez is like, listen, he makes it super clear, I don't believe you at all. But he bluffs and he tells her that a secret grand jury is being formed and she'd better figure out if she's going to keep lying for Matt or not, because, you know, you don't want to do that. So Vanessa is subpoenaed to testify before a grand jury, and it's made really, really clear to her, listen, if you lie or you perjure yourself on the stand, this is going to be bad news bear for you, sister. So she gets on the stand and she's asked if she'd been told anything about Carrie Baker's death, to which now she replies under oath, quote, yes, he told me he killed her because of me. Well, that's a pretty big change of tune there. So Matt is arrested and Vanessa is offered immunity if she's willing to testify against him. So now it's 4 years after Carrie's death. Matt's tried for murder and is advised not to take the stand for fear of being like ripped to shit on cross-examination. And that was probably a smart move. So, after covering for Matt, lying her ass off to investigators for 4 years with immunity, Vanessa is now ready to be honest. So, she admits to the whole affair while Carrie was alive, which, so Carrie was right, like she was dead on. She also shares that Matt hated Carrie and wanted out of the marriage. Matt referred to her as, quote, a fat bitch and, quote, couldn't stand how fat she'd gotten and that he wanted her out of his life. And I feel like I need to pause here because I'm just getting mad and point out to the listener, if you haven't looked the guy up already, that Pastor Matt himself is not a particularly in shape guy, right? He's got a, you know, Friar Tuck thing going on. So, you know, fuck him. But anyways, back to Vanessa's testimony. So she tells the court that Matt planned to make Carrie's death look like an overdose since she took sleeping pills every night because of grief over their lost daughter, Cassidy. On the night of the murder, Matt told Vanessa he handcuffed his wife to the bed and how he, quote, kissed her forehead, then said he got a pillow and placed it over her face. I will spare you the details, but Vanessa does go into detail about Matt suffocating his wife with his hand in the pillow. And it was consistent with the bruising that, remember, they found on Carrie's face after her body was exhumed. So the jury comes back and thank God they find Matt Baker guilty of murder. Because she was offered immunity though, Vanessa, who had full prior knowledge, of this plot during their affair, when it happened, after it happened, but because she had immunity, you know, that Vanessa's not going to be charged with any part in the crime. So at sentencing, Matt finally speaks and shocker, he says he disagrees with the verdict and that, quote, the jury got it all wrong. of course he fucking did. So, you know, Carrie's mom though, Linda Doolin, she's not done with Matt. So, you know, she gets the opportunity to address him in court and dude, she goes in on him. She hits him with the Matt, look at me. Matt, she loved you. And this dude couldn't even look her in the eyes. And you know what? But watching Linda Doolin just tear into Matt, it was, you know, it's heartbreaking, but also, you know, really satisfying to watch. Because like one of the investigators said, you know, on one of the videos I watched, he knows this kind of guy. This is the kind of guy that thinks he's smarter than everybody else. Just like a textbook narcissistic sociopath. So, you know, seeing this guy, you know, have to, you know, at least hear from his victim's mom, very satisfying. You know, so anyways, Matt is sentenced to 65 years in prison with the possibility of parole. But you know what? Here's the thing. If I had to guess, if the day comes and Matt is even alive to go before that parole board, the Doolins are going to be right there waiting, making sure he doesn't get the opportunity to get out and hurt anybody else. So, you know, what are my takeaways from this? I mean, I guess just to trust your instincts. You know, Carrie knew that Matt was up to something, and I can only speculate, but, you know, I feel like if she voiced her concerns to him, he probably was the type to, you know, gaslight her and, you know, tell her that she was wrong or she was imagining it. And same with the Doolins. Despite Carrie's death immediately being ruled a suicide by the professionals, they knew things were on the up and up. And, you know, thank God they fought tooth and nail and the case, you know, was reopened. But I guess all that to say, you know, we have these gut feelings and we have these instincts about people and they're instilled in us for a reason, right? Like it's a survival feature. And if something seems off with someone, it probably is. And I'd love to hear your thoughts. You know, maybe you already knew about this case or you've, you know, seen the Murderous Affairs episode on Netflix, but do you think Matt Baker's punishment fit the crime? How do you feel about Vanessa Bowles facing basically no punishment in exchange for her testimony? I'd love to hear what you think. And, you know, you can send me an email or a DM on Instagram and, you know, let me know your feedback on the Matt and Carrie Baker case. But that's, you know, that's all I have for tonight. You know, I really appreciate you joining me. I definitely want to do more true crime episodes. And if there are any cases that are local to you or ones that you just want me to do a really deep dive into, and do a full episode on, please, again, you send me a message or send me a DM. Also, don't forget to like, comment, subscribe to the Your Best School podcast. Wherever you get your podcasts, we're on Apple, Spotify, you know, you name it, we're on it. And I'd also love it if you followed me on Instagram at Your Best School. And my regular Instagram is at Nicolette Noree. And just a reminder to check out the apparel and accessories in the Your Best School podcast shop. And that's, you know, linked in my bios. It's also on the Ghoul's Best Friend site. Like I said, you know, shirts, home decor, and all of the sales, the proceeds will go toward, you know, improving the quality of this podcast. And if you've got a real life scary story, paranormal, true crime, urban legend, or otherwise, or just, you know, have something creepy that you want me to look up and do an episode on, I would love it if you let me know. And if you want to be interviewed for the show too, I would love that too. So just send me a DM on Instagram or go to ghoulsbestfriend.com and submit your stuff. But again, I'm sorry for, you know, being gone for so long, but I am back. We'll be back every week. So I hope you have an amazing weekend. Please stay safe and warm out there and keep it creepy.